Welcome back to the Voices of the Middle East. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is a special program titled 2 Years and Two Wars After 9/11, 2001. I'm Gudarz Ektidari, your host. And now we're going to start changing the gear, so to speak. And Gabi, my co-host tonight, has done some research on statistics and quotes that we gathered around the harassment, intimidation, and a stereotype of Muslim Americans after the 9/11, which basically are gathered from several organizations who did issue reports on this. One of them is Human Rights Watch, a human rights watchdog from out of New York, and the other one is ADC, American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. So, Gabi, what do you find?
Actually, they did a lot of research, and we can, it's all available on the web, and we can give the addresses at the end of the show. What I found was that the road towards hatred and stereotyping of Muslims and or people from the Middle East was paved long before the events of September 11th. The media is notorious in dehumanizing people from the region. So-called news programs routinely reserve undefined terms such as terrorist, fundamentalist, fanatic, for one group of people and members of one religion only, while rarely telling the stories and names of individuals from that group as either victims, heroes, or just ordinary folk. More recently, and before Portlander Mike Maher Havash was ever officially charged with anything, the Oregonians, Dave Reinhardt, had him convicted to be a holy warrior based on his Islamic whiskers, and I'm quoting directly from Reinhardt's editorials. The negative portrayal of people from the region in the entertainment industry is very well documented by Jack Shaheen, who summarizes the typical character roles as billionaires, bombers, and belly dancers in his books Real Bad Arabs. The original version of Disney's Aladdin started with the following song. Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam, where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. There was nothing rational or justifiable about the surge in hate crimes against Muslims or people mistaken as such, which followed the tragedy of September 11. How ignorant and based on constructed images these crimes were can be illustrated with the fact that many of the injured or murdered victims were actually Indian. The reason they were targeted is as simple as it is painful. Osama bin Laden and many TV Arabs wear turbans, so do many Indian Sikh. There were 700 such attacks just in the first 9 weeks following September 11. Examples of these crimes include an incident in Oregon, which fortunately did not end up with the death of the victim. This just happened at the beginning of this year. The target was Nahir Patel, a 24-year-old native of India, who was mistaken for an Arab by three members of the Oregon National Guard who just had returned from a tour of duty in the Middle East. They attacked him in his motel. One of them struck him with a gun and forced his way with Patel in his home, which was behind his workplace. There, his wife began to scream and called 911, at which point the attacker fled. Unfortunately, Patel survived. Others were not so fortunate. Another example was Balbir Singh Sudi, a 49-year-old Sikh and father of three, who was shot and killed while planting flour at his gas station on September 15, 2002. The police officials told Human Rights Watch that hours before the crime, Sodi's alleged killer, Frank Rock, had bragged at a local bar of his intention to kill the ragheads responsible for September 11. In addition to shooting Sodi three times before driving away, Rock also allegedly shot into the home of an Afghan-American and at two Lebanese gas station clerks. Another example is a man named Ali W. Ali, a 66-year-old Somali Muslim who died 9 days after being punched in the head while standing at a bus stop in Minneapolis, Minnesota on October 15, 2002. According to press reports, the only known witness to the attack saw the assailant walk up to Ali, punch him, stand over him, and then walk away. His son and Somali community members attributed the attack against Ali to anger created against Somalis by a front-page local newspaper article that appeared 2 days prior to the attack. In that newspaper article, some local Minnesota Somalis were accused of having funded organizations belonging to Osama bin Laden. Muslims and or people from the Middle East came under attack in many other ways. While some members of the U.S. government gave official lip service to wanting to prevent a lashing out against Muslims, actual policies and implementations did exactly that and effectively not only negated all supportive statements, but also gave indirect approval to stigmatizing and blaming large groups of people simply based on religion and ethnicity. Approximately 1,200 mostly Muslim men were detained without charges, access to lawyers and families, and it being known who and where they were. The U.S. government still refuses to release the names of these men even after they were court-ordered to do so after the American Arab Anti-Discrimination League sued. None of these men have ever been charged with any crimes related to the events of September 11th. An example for these men is Mohammed Rafik Butt. Mr. Butt had come to New York to work and send money back to his children in Pakistan. The FBI arrested him when neighbors called in on a tip. They turned him over to the Immigration and Naturalization Service on September 20th. Never charged with a crime, he was held on a visa violation and ordered deported. He died in a New Jersey jail on October 24th. Other prisoners told Boot's relatives that he had complained of chest pains for 2 days. Officials refused to take him to a hospital. INS officials claim Boot had a heart attack. The INS refuses to release information about his death to Human Rights Watch. Immigration officials told the group that they must produce a document signed by Boot. Boot's relatives in Pakistan, after his body was returned to Pakistan, told a newspaper in North Carolina that he seemed to have been tortured prior to his death. Another example was that thousands of Muslim men from a long list of Middle Eastern countries were forced to voluntarily register with the INS, in the process of which hundreds of them were detained, mostly Iranians in California, and many were deported. Equally, none of these men have ever been charged with any crimes related to September 11. Muslim and Middle Eastern men continue to be harassed while traveling and face new discriminatory procedures such as fingerprinting and mandatory registrations if they want to come to the United States. Incidents of people assumed to be Muslim taken off airplanes were illegal but continued long after September 11. They include the story of a Bosnian man in a wheelchair who was forced off an Alaska Airlines plane in Portland, Oregon, after he had already boarded because somebody on board felt uncomfortable. If you're interested in these reports, all these incidents are well documented, and there are websites where you can download the reports. The Human Rights Watch website is www.hrw.org, and American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee is www.adc.org, and there also is an organization called bluetriangle.org, and that is also www.bluetriangle.org on the web.
Okay, in order to think about why these incidents are happening, one can really look into some quotes from people who are mainstream individuals, such as the person that we talked about a lot in the first half of the show, such as Daniel Pipes, who was just recently being appointed as a board member of the U.S. Institute for Peace. And I read from one of his article in New York Post. It says, "We're going to conquer America." He says, "The Muslim population is not like any other, for it harbors a substantial body, one many times larger than the agents of Osama bin Laden, who have worrisome aspirations for the United States. Although not responsible for the atrocities in September, these people share important goals with the suicide hijackers. Both despise the United States and ultimately wish to transform it into a Muslim country. The ambition to take over the United States is hardly a new one. The first Islamic missionaries from abroad arrived in the 1920s and unblushingly declared, "Our plan is we are going to conquer America." Such hopes have become commonplace in recent years. And this is from a New York Post article on November 12, 2001 by Daniel Pipes. And there are many other, I guess, quotes that we can read to basically explain why these things are happening. I guess now we can open our phone line if any of our listeners have comments or have questions that we might be able to answer. They can call in. The number is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. If you have a question or comment regarding the topic of the show tonight, you're very welcome to call in. One thing that I want to mention, Gabi talked about INS gathering some of these Middle Eastern people, especially in Southern California, and kind of detaining around 2,000 of them who didn't have really much to do with anything, basically. They only had probably INS violation. Most of them were in process of changing a status, and their applications were kind of delayed. However, they were supposed to report by, I guess, 10th of December of last year, December of 2002, and they were all, this is a group of 13 countries, the first group that they announced that they had to go and register with INS. And some of them were detained, some of them were released on bail. The families were separated based on that interview process. And very interesting and very strange thing that happened was some of them were imprisoned in New Mexico and in San Diego who did not have any document. They did not have any Iranian passport, for example. And I'm talking about 70 of them who were Iranian and they were supposed to be deported to Iran. They did not have any paperwork because they came as refugee to this country, or they had lost their passport, or they used to stay, I mean, to be in the U.S. during the Islamic Revolution. So they did not have really any paperwork. And they were not, I mean, INS and the United States government could not deport them without any documentation. They could not put them in the airplane to go back to Iran because there's no direct flight from here. So what they did, they arranged for Iranian embassy, which is actually U.S. do not have, they don't have a relation with Iran. So they arranged for representative of the interest section of Islamic Republic in Washington, D.C. to fly to San Diego and New Mexico and issue paperwork for these folks and deport them back to Iran. These are strange things that happened after 9/11, even though Iran was considered a part of the axis of evil. But at this case, actually, State Department, I mean, INS through the State Department did cooperate with interest section of Islamic Republic to deport these people back to Iran. Again, the number is 503-231-8187. If you have any comment or question, you're welcome to call in. I believe Gabi has something else to say.
Not really. No. There are other stories I could read about examples of what happened to detainees. For example, there was a 20-year-old Pakistani student who was arrested on an expired visa while he was riding an express bus through Mississippi on his way to New York. He was taken to the closest correctional facility where he was locked up with hostile inmates who harassed him and beat him severely, calling him Bin Laden. They stripped him naked, beat him until his eardrum ruptured, broke his tooth and fractured his rib. The student alleged that the guards did not do anything to stop the attacks, which continued for 20 minutes after the victim rang the alarm bell. A week after the assault, he could not hear through his left ear nor eat solid foods because his tongue was swollen and he had pains in his jaw. There, I mean, one could argue how deeply of a crime it is to be undocumented. The fact is that there is millions of people in the United States who are undocumented, but after September 11, those that were picked up with those charges, sometimes as trivial as not having changed your address with the INS, which I'm an immigrant myself, I haven't done that for the last 15 years, and I've never been bothered because of it. So they picked up Middle Eastern or Muslim men and then detained them. Detention is a fancy word. They threw them in ordinary prisons where, on top of harassment by the guards, they were also assaulted by other prisoners in many cases.
And also there are some statistics on how many times the hate crimes against Arabs and Muslims have gone up between the 9/11 and after 9/11. For example, in the year 2000, the whole year, there has been 25 hate crimes registered in the whole United States, while in 2001 and note that 2001, actually, it's only 3 months after the 9/11. Within that 3 months, this number has kind of gone up 20 times. It's like 480 hate crimes was registered in the whole United States. In Los Angeles County, it went up from 5 to 200. In Chicago, it went up from 0 to 51. The hate crimes during 2001, but before and after September 11, in Phoenix there was zero before September 11, and then after that, within that 3 months, it jumped up to 43. In Massachusetts, it was three before 9/11, and then after 9/11, in that 3 months, it was 82. So there is a really a height in the number, in a huge increase in the number of hate crimes against Muslims and Arabs and the people who looked like them. And that's actually the title of the report by Human Rights Watch that says hate crimes against Arabs, Muslims, and those perceived to be Arab or Muslim after September 11.
And these hate crimes were the assaults and murders, but they also include vandalism, such as somebody spraying the word murderer on a driveway belonging to a Muslim family in Vancouver, Washington, or somebody else set fires and spray painted Nazi swastikas on four businesses owned by Americans of Iran and an African origin in Vancouver, Washington. So some of these things happen locally. And what concerns me at least as much is the more subtle day-to-day remarks and assumptions people make about Muslims, people from the Middle East. It's always there. And I work in the public school system. I know it's always there. And I know what an impact it has on especially children from these communities.
Let's listen to a piece of music, and then we'll come back and continue. Apparently, we have a caller, so we go to that phone call.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, thank you. Hi, I appreciate your show here today. I just wanted to make mostly a comment. On September 11th, 2001, I was standing two blocks away from the World Trade Center and saw both planes enter the buildings and the first building come down. And this was probably the most horrific event that I've experienced in my life up to this point. But I know that there are many other on this planet that are experiencing this every day. Living in New York, I also noticed a lot of people missing afterwards, a lot of people just automatically taken from their shops. And my heart goes out to the families and to the people that are still suffering from this event, as well as myself. I just want to send out love today on this day. It's very significant, and I feel very glad to be alive and to be able to be speaking right now. So, okay, I think that's it.
thank you for your call. And
yeah.
Quite honestly, the Middle Eastern community and Muslim community in the United States were among the people who were affected most, and they're still paying the price for something that they haven't committed. And I personally have gone through this this pressure from the day one. From the minute I was leaving my house that 9/11 Tuesday morning, and my daughter rushed out. I was getting into the car, and she came out and said, "Daddy, Daddy, two planes went through the Twin Towers." And I did not believe it at that moment, and I thought something wrong with her, or I don't know. She said, it's on TV right now. So we went back, but then I had to go to work. I didn't know whether I should go to work, I should not go to work, because I had experienced the bombing of Oklahoma City Federal Building. That day also, I had this trauma of what to expect, especially right after the bombing, there was this news. So most, I guess, Muslims and people from the Middle East in the U.S. were praying that this time it's not going to be again something related to our region. But unfortunately, it was. And since then, I guess everybody in the Middle East and in the U.S., they have had their prayers for the people who survived that day and that event. And quite honestly, we are impacted by it. Whether the root of those fundamentalism or terrorism or whatever you want to call it, where is the root and how this happened and how that was really basically built and planted in this universe, is the question that we are trying to find the answer for. But there is a Persian saying that says, if you plant a wind, you will harvest a storm. And that's what is happening in the Middle East today as well.
Just like people to know that the music you are listening to is from an oud player from Iraq, and the piece was composed in memory of the children of the shelter in Al-Amiraya that was bombed during the first or the beginning of the long Iraq war.
90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, 91.9 Columbia Gorge, 100.7 Willamette Valley, providing programming to diverse communities and unserved or underserved groups. Prison Pipeline Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m., hosted by Ann Rose Pierce, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.